Mr. Goldsmith, if you please.
Welcome to The Goldsmith Odyssey, a chronological journey through the works of composer Jerry Goldsmith. I'm David.
I'm Yavar.
I'm Jens.
And I'm Clark.
As you've just heard, the esteemed W. David Lichty has joined us once again, the first guest to join us twice, and the first guest to join us twice in a row on The Goldsmith Odyssey, and certainly deserving of, is that, shall we call it an honor? It's a something.
It's an honor to me.
Thank you for being with us, David.
Yeah, sure, of course. Glad to.
And he did it despite suffering with us through Man on the Beach. He somehow agreed to come back.
I just consider it good hazing.
Yeah.
It can only go up from here.
Right. Once you've run the gauntlet, it's all just cake after that.
Yeah.
But in this case, David is more than just a guest host joining us. He's more of a guest producer on this special episode because after our opening section, he personally arranged and selected all of the music that we're going to be discussing.
We really appreciate your hard work on this, David.
Sure. It was a joy. It was a treasure hunt with quite a bit of gold to be found. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, my. Overall, the whole show is music from the CBS Music Library. Different sources, but that source material that CBS stored and kept to use as trackable background music for different programs. And some of it comes from previous CD release, and some of it had to be excavated.
And this is all material which, as best as we can tell, with one possible exception, was not written for any specific program in mind. In other words, there was a lot of music that existed in the CBS Music Library that was originally written for a project like A Marriage of Strangers from Playhouse 90, or there were a few cues from Have Gun Will Travel, Sergeant and the Lady, and as we discussed on the last episode, Man on the Beach and The Fair-Haired Boy. But there were a great number of cues which all the documentation points to it being standalone and having been composed, the term is wild, as in not to picture. It is out there in the wild, it does not have a normal home.
And would you agree that, you know, though some library music is easily recognizable as such, in other cases we were not quite so sure?
Some of them you can tell are written with repeating cells so that the music editor can kind of cut it wherever he feels like, and it noticeably doesn't sound like a cue that Jerry would be writing to picture. But other ones, perhaps because we're only getting fragments of them that were on isolated score tracks and such, they don't have that nature to them, at least in the potentially truncated form we have, so it's harder to tell.
The earliest example I have of us getting access or information about this library or music from it is on that 40th anniversary Twilight Zone CD, the first disc of which was devoted to Bernard Herrmann. And what was unique to his contributions, because a lot of the material had been released on LPs before, but they included a thing called the Outer Space Suite, which came specifically from Bernard Herrmann's compositions written for the CBS Music Library. And if people are familiar with that, they'll have some idea of what we're talking about with how library tracks can sound. He sort of set the tone for those. And then I assume that one of the next sort of best examples would be the Prometheus CD that we're going to be referring to.
It's worth noting that Jerry Goldsmith was one of countless composers who worked at CBS and contributed to this library either with music written for programs or music that was written as just wild library music to be tracked in.
Right. I mean, as much stuff as we have on the program here today, his contributions arguably even could be considered minimal in comparison to some of the composers who wrote music for that library.
We know that during the early 50s, CBS began collecting scores to form a library. For much of the decade, Every score composed by a musician on the CBS payroll was recorded and saved as stock music to be tracked into new programs by a music editor in lieu of having original scores composed. Jerry was either on contract to CBS from 1952 to 1960, that's what he told NBC in 1990, or from 1955 to 62, which is what he told John Burlingame in Jens's favorite interview. So in that zone, but whichever way it goes, he had a 7-year contract, and so during that time, all of his scores got archived in this way. The library is vast. When I look at Bill Robel's documents, he has listed a number of Jerry Goldsmith cues, and we have sections of about 1/3 of the names on his list of the things that he found stored at UCLA. So even Goldsmith's wild cues far surpass what we're going to hear some of today. So this is something that could be due for a multi-disc CD set that would probably thrill a lot of people if it had the quality of the Prometheus stuff.
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Since David mentions the Prometheus CD, known as Jerry Goldsmith, The Early Years, Volume 1, today is the day that we will be closing the books on it, because the last bit of it that we haven't covered are the couple of library cues that have been released in nice quality on that CD, and most of them are CBS Easy Cue tracks, which brings me to the Easy Cue library, which we've of course talked about before, but I don't think we've been clear on the distinction. I know with certainty that I'm responsible for using the term interchangeably on a couple of occasions when I really shouldn't have.
And I know that I don't know the distinction at all.
The Easy Cue library was a series of LPs that were produced, I guess, for music editors. And they didn't contain the full contents of the CBS music library because they were so vast. But it was probably just kind of a representative selection of highlights that would have descriptions next to each track just to give them sort of a text version of what's going on in the cue so that they could know what situations it might be appropriate to drop those cues in for.
So the Easy Cue library is a subset of the overall CBS music library, and you're saying that someone went through and found tracks that they thought were particularly universal or multiplicably applicable and then just created labeling so they would be easy. There we go. For other music editors to apply rather than having to have a knowledge of the whole library. Is that what you're saying it is?
Precisely. I think the whole library was probably too unwieldy for practical application, especially since they didn't have computers back then. It still ended up being dozens upon dozens of LPs full of these Easy Cue tracks, but it was much more manageable than the entire vast library. And, you know, the other helpful element was the descriptions, which I know Jens is looking forward to reading for the cues we have descriptions.
I've been looking forward to this forever because I know we've joked about this in previous episodes and referred to our own notes and how they would compare to the Easy Cue library, but I don't think people have had the context.
At long last, the payoff that you've all been waiting for.
Yep, now you've got to go listen to the first 10 episodes and appreciate the Easy Cue humor.
Our jokes require deep, intense research.
Unfortunately, this first cue doesn't actually appear to be part of the Easy Cue or Transworld library, so it's called The Villagers, but we don't have a description for it.
So you're going to have to wait just a little bit longer. Hold on, I know you're all very excited.
I'll set it up by saying that it's a terrific example, in my opinion, of Jerry writing something that, while it isn't a picture, is just so evocative of its specific setting that you can imagine the kind of scene that it's meant to underscore immediately upon starting the cue. It's this celebratory dance with a slight Hispanic flavor.
I like the folksy instrumentation in it.
I say close your eyes, and it's easy to picture villagers frolicking in the village square, perhaps dancing around a fire or a banquet.
This is pretty easily my favorite of the cues on the Prometheus album. It's so charming and enthusiastic. It's full of warmth and life. And yeah, I completely agree, Jens. You can close your eyes and instantly imagine, if not the specific scene, the kind of scene this would be accompanying.
Sure, in some way it's maybe generic, but it's also, in a way, part of what's important about being generic is nothing on earth is really generic. And so to be properly generic, you also kind of have to be specific. It's a hard line to walk, and Goldsmith walks it well because Jens is right. It does immediately call not just some place. I mean, we may all think of a different kind of a place, but if we compared them, there would be similarities that come out of this music, like maybe it's dusk or maybe it's night or maybe it's warm or things like that. And that's all coming from the specificity in this music, even though it's designed to be used in a variety of places.
But my last note about it would be, it does feel more repetitive than your average Goldsmith cue might if he were actually writing to picture.
You can tell that with the repeating sections, it's designed to be cut for length if it needs to be.
Yeah.
For this next batch of cues, we actually have a scan of the corresponding CBS EZQ index, complete with the patented cue descriptions. And all of the EZQ tracks on the early years are from one particular collection, number 143, entitled Asiatic, Indian, and Chinese Backgrounds. The early years album combines and reorders some of these pieces, but we'll cover them as they appear on the EZQ index. Ooh. So the first cue from this collection on the index is The Camp, which EZQ describes as Misterioso, suspended bridge, Indian flavor with muted horns, xylophone, and bells.
It's not a million miles away from Silence, that little tonka from 1,489 words in terms of its feel.
It's the evolutionary bridge between Silence and Rambo First Blood Part 2.
What a journey.
Yes, that's the Asian connection I wanted to bring up, because the opening of this cue immediately made me think of an Asian motif in Rambo First Blood Part 2, where it's taken almost directly from this. And it's, I think, going to surprise a lot of listeners who think that maybe this early library music is not as important, but they love the Rambo scores. Well, this little germ is the origin for some of the music you really love.
You know, Yavar, the whole tone of this piece, those threatening minor key horn motifs, it all feels like it could fit into the more stealthy sections of that movie.
Except it doesn't have the directionality of those cues. It doesn't have the journey like there is with almost everything Goldsmith ever wrote. It could keep going on forever and you wouldn't notice. It could just repeat on a loop. To me, it's almost like what Jerry Goldsmith would have written if he'd scored a computer game. Like, go into a camp in some role-playing game or something, and it's just playing in the background in it, and it's designed to loop.
Yes, that's very sharp. It doesn't respond to a dramatic event. There's no point where you say, oh, look, she just slapped him. There's nothing like that in the cue.
Yeah, I know what you mean. This sounds like music, you know, for a specific location to set a mood, not really to underscore anything in particular, but just to kind of provide a vibe while you're walking around in this area.
Precisely. Location without events.
Yeah, yeah. This is very much in that vein.
Do you want to mention the camp at night?
Yeah, a variant of this cue. A little more subdued and less forceful in places, but mostly identical.
Yeah, I had to listen to these a few times before I could really spot the differences between them. They're very similar. The music continues in a similar vein in the next cue, Quiet Night.
Mm-hmm. Here's the description. Soft Indian bridge. Predominant instruments are harp, flute, and Indian drums. Strong oriental flavor.
That's interesting because it links it to both Native American and Asian settings in that description. And I think that this is a case where it's a little bit vague which one it is. Because the instrumentation and the use of the pentatonic scale makes it a little bit confusing. I'm kind of leaning more towards Native American sound in this piece.
The implication there being, you know, if you have an Asian scene or if you have a Native American scene, that maybe you can plug this in and make it work in either situation for TV viewers of the 1950s or 60s.
It's just vague enough.
Yeah, something about it's got these insistent drums, which I guess could be Asian, but it gives it a little bit of an Indian flavor to me with the chimes and the harp and other instruments. But over those at the bass, there's a flute that's carrying the melody, and it feels a bit like a Native American or imitation Native American flute.
I think you're right, because the Native American vibe, at least the stereotypical Native American vibe, in part comes from the way those drums are mic'd, I guess. They definitely sound like full and distant, which is the evocative distant drums sort of a thing. So yes, if you had on screen all of these stereotypical Native American visuals, the flute would simply be the melody or theme of the show. Conversely, if you had stereotypical Asian visuals on screen, you might more notice that flute theme, and the other part would just be this background. And I wonder how well that worked in those two different types of settings.
Yeah, aren't distant drums a wonderful cliche?
They are indeed.
Mm-hmm.
This is indubitably a further thematic development of the camp. It takes that cue xylophone motif and condenses it to a quick three notes, very quick. But then it takes the flute motif and turns it into kind of a meatier, more long-form theme. But it definitely seems like it's a direct, pretty straightforward development of the theme that's established in the camp.
And it makes you wonder when you first hear those too, you know, was this music originally attached to some score since you have these continuing themes? But no, it seems like this is just Goldsmith offering different takes on similar thematic ideas.
The break between this and the two camp cues for me is I don't hear Rambo First Blood Part 2 in it, and I do hear an Indian sound to it, which I didn't in the camp. I can't make out any sort of Indian influence, but the cue this sounds much more similar to me with is the next one, Village Death.
Oh yeah, Village Death, clearly in continuity with the two cues that we just heard.
It feels maybe a bit more fateful with the brass weighing down the flute protagonist in the music, if you will. The gongs and the bass drums, they get more and more weighty and dark at the end as the piece reaches the climax.
This piece is described by Easy Q very simply, low, dark, Indian suspense bridge.
Thank you.
So far, this is the first one that is showing up in a Twilight Zone. It's used four times in the first episode of Season 5 called The Seventh is Made Up of Phantoms. It's the only place it's used. It's used right at the beginning, 2 minutes in, and then 10 and 11 minutes in. So it's clearly something that the music editor found versatile enough to use throughout that particular episode as a distinctive, as a signature of that particular episode. Part of what you guys are talking about is how there are two things you're going to want to do with wild cues. And one is that video game background looping music style thing. But the other is you're going to have to write cues where something does happen. And the composer has to provide a music editor with something that has a spot where, you know, when the handkerchief is lifted and the knife is revealed to be sitting on the table, there's a spot in the music that goes right there. And before it, it's kind of maybe languid. And after it, it's kind of intense. But it makes sense that he would compose cues that have those kinds of moments in them, I think.
So it would be easy enough for an editor to say, okay, we'll take this piece, we'll back up, you know, 30 seconds before the intense bit and let that sort of moodier music play, and then it'll time out nicely and with this climax here.
That's exactly how you would time it, and then you would fade it in and fade it out as needed according to the length of the scene.
Now, on the Prometheus album, the Village Death cue is longer than on the Easy Cues discs because it actually has an alternate of knife fight tacked on at the end. And that's the cue that we opened the podcast with, but we played the version that was marked at the end of Mysterious Storm on the album. And now to discuss it, we'll play you the version that's at the end of Village Death without being labeled.
It's like a Beatles session. There's almost no difference between these two. I visually line those up for Yavar, and one of them goes on for an extra two notes. It's like take 13 and take 14 of I'll Be On My Way. If you match them up, it's not the exact same performance, but clearly a very tight orchestra and Jerry Goldsmith timing very well because they stack up perfectly. They're almost indistinguishable. They're less distinguishable than the two different versions of Love Me Do, the album and the single release.
So you think that it's the same composition and just a different performance of it?
I think it's exactly, there's take one and take two of the exact same composition.
Whereas Camp at Night, maybe they said, now we're going to slow down the tempo.
And right, because there's going to be a scene in the daytime when stuff's going on and a scene at night when two guys are talking by the fire. These two, they're alternate takes like a jazz alternate take.
According to Easy Cue, this is a wild, excited fight with some Indian flavor to brass tail.
Brass tail?
Yes. What they mean is that it ends with us on a strong brassy note.
Ending, yeah.
Oh, sure.
For me, this cue is actually the highlight of the Prometheus material in either version. It doesn't have that static nature to it, perhaps because it's short, or perhaps because it's an action cue, but for me, it's just really exciting with great percussion. I think the one thing that clues me into it being a library cue composed wild is that it doesn't really have a strong, recognizable theme to grab onto, which I think makes it more versatile and reusable, because you don't want a really standout theme on library music to some degree, because then when it gets used in a different context later on the same show or something,
people are going to say, I remember this.
Yeah, it'll create this link you don't want. I mean, it's not like none of the library music we'll be discussing today has straightforward themes in it, but it's less often than usual for Jerry Goldsmith because I think it's supposed to be more universally usable.
As you say, a few exceptions, but not a lot of these cues leave you humming something a few minutes after you've finished listening to them. It sets a mood, but without actually getting that melody that's going to stick with you.
Last but not least, there's Mysterious Storm. If you're a Twilight Zone fan, this should be familiar, if not downright iconic, since it is a cue that appears in some of the show's most beloved episodes, such as The Howling Man and Death's Head Revisited. In fact, I so associated with Death's Head Revisited, a episode in which it has a very prominent place, and for such a distinctive piece of music, the easy cue description is surprisingly spare. It says, low mysterious brass punctuations.
And that's it.
That's it.
Just checking really quick, David, was knife fight used in any Twilight Zones to your knowledge?
It was not.
Okay, good. So of these Prometheus cues, it's just Village Death and Mysterious Storm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah, and Jens is dead right. Mysterious Storm tracks it in 7 times, and they range in length from 8 seconds to a minute and 30 seconds straight.
Wow.
Just the same cue, not even an alternate or anything.
That's right. All Mysterious Storm.
This is why I'll always think of it as the theme from Death's Head Revisited, which is a very strong Twilight Zone, by the way. One of the greats.
So does it not get repetitive over the course of that episode, since the cue itself is somewhat repetitive?
It works because it's meant to be repetitive in that episode. It's about a guy who worked in the concentration camp who's got to revisit the horrors of what he's done, and he's haunted by it, and this theme just follows him around.
Like an antagonistic haunt.
Yeah, that little four-note motif. And some later on, you have those kind of harsh strings that accompany it.
It doesn't have a huge change. It kind of repeats the same material for a while, then a very slight change repeats that for a little bit. And then at the end, it just goes into a faster tempo version of the same material for a bit.
It's funny that Easy Cue Library just calls it mysterious. I find it to be pretty menacing.
Yeah, it definitely has a sinister feel.
And in fact, you'll forgive me for making another Bernard Herrmann comparison, but this feels as much like Herrmann as anything that I've heard Jerry write so far.
Likely not the last Herrmann comparison we'll hear on this episode.
And sensible given the fact that Herrmann had already been recording things for the CBS music library directly. I mean, if you're Jerry coming in on Herman's heels, you're going to look and say, well, this is what he's doing. This is the kind of thing that seems to work. I'm going to do something that's similar, in at least in structure, if not style.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be versatile like that, where it could fit. And Mysterious Storm really does feel like it fits with the mostly Bernard Herrmann library music of The Howling Man.
With this material, for the most part, I'd say Jerry wasn't trying to stand out as much. I can still tell most of this stuff is Jerry Goldsmith, but it wasn't like showing off his stylistic uniqueness. That wasn't the point. It was so that it could be used with a lot of music that was written by other composers like Bernard Herrmann and not call attention to itself as being stylistically apart.
Goldsmith kind of writing conservatively in the style of the time. His voice is still there, but it's not Goldsmith Unleashed, to say the least.
The exceptions, I would say, are maybe some of the action-y bits. Does Knife Fight sound like it'd be written by any other composer this time?
Knife Fight is a Goldsmith action cue.
Knife Fight's pretty darn good.
Just wish it were longer.
Knife Fights don't last very long.
I will say one thing about the size of it, though. Goldsmith had to know, he knew the economy of television production, and he knew that a fight scene probably was only going to last so long just because they're hard to stage. They may involve stuntmen, they may involve the breaking of things, and so an average action moment is going to be 30 seconds long, 45 seconds long. Therefore, we're getting a piece that easily fits that.
On these programs, it wasn't like a film where there'd be an extended action set piece like he'd get later in his career, or not even just later. He had 2-minute long highlight action cue at the end of Face of a Fugitive that we discussed, and that's not something that would happen on a TV show usually.
Not a 26-minute long TV show especially.
That's the disappointing thing, though, that these TV scores do not have the space for him to do the things that we like.
Well, and that's the frustrating thing about this library music. As good as lots of it is, it doesn't showcase the strongest element of Jerry Goldsmith as a composer, which is his continual development of his thematic material over the course of a score and the journey it takes. And here, even when we're lucky enough to get a standout melody, it's usually just a one-off, or maybe he uses it in another cue or two, but he can't develop it and make it grow like he would in a proper film score.
Yeah, and that's part of what makes it harder to judge than a lot of the music we're covering on the Goldsmith Odyssey. It's clear that he did his job, and he did it well. And it's interesting to look at from a historical standpoint, but it is tricky to compare this to a lot of other Goldsmith stuff because the nature of the assignment is so different.
So that concludes our coverage of Easy Cue and the early years, putting a bow on that album finally.
By Prometheus CD.
You treated us well.
Great minds.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Clark.
I mean, to be honest, the Prometheus cues, they're all really, really nice. They sound good. Part of that is I'm used to hearing all these Twilights on isolated scores, and the quality on the Prometheus disc is wonderful. So, you know, everybody get it.
Yep. We're finally ready to get into the music that David brought us. David, you pulled from the best sources available to you.
Yes.
And you put them together as seamlessly as you could.
As I could. Well, I do want to say up front, the one thing that we're not going to be able to hear is Jerry's submission for a Twilight Zone theme, second season, when they dropped Herman's really mysterious, kind of swirly, cloudy opening, which is really quite wonderful for season one. Goldsmith and frankly, I'd say my other favorite composer of classic science fiction films, Leith Stevens, they each contributed a potential new Twilight Zone theme, and we, as far as I know, don't have access to any of those. So that's not part of this, unfortunately, because I'd love to hear that.
And another mystery is the CBS logo music that Jerry is supposed to have written.
Right, which we might have from YouTube, but the problem is in identifying it. Most of the CBSI logos were silent for a while. He composed, I think, 3 little tracks in 60 or 61, and you can find, you know, logos circa 1960 on YouTube, but whether that's actually him or not, it's hard to tell. So what we have a lot of otherwise unavailable music in relatively good quality that comes from the Twilight Zone Blu-ray's isolated score tracks. And the way I got this, basically we've got, I'd say, 3 big people to thank. One is Martin Grams Jr., the author of Twilight Zone Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic, which is, you know, for those who are big Twilight Zone fans, there's already a Twilight Zone Bible called the Twilight Zone Companion. This is basically the second one. Very thorough, very well researched, very well documented. Things like production costs, how much was the secretary paid? I mean, all kinds of wild details.
The whole reason he wrote the book is because he came across all this information and said, I have to do something with this.
Right. In fact, I think it was the music information primarily that got him started. And we were discussing, in preparation for coming into the Twilight Zone episodes, we were talking about, you know, were you going to mention where The Invaders was used in other episodes? And he said, oh, you know, maybe if we can figure that out. And I did a little poking around, wound up on his website, which had his section of his book devoted to the episode To Serve Man. And it listed every individual cue, all 47 different cues tracked into To Serve Man, with the running time of the cue, the composer of the cue, and the name of the cue, at which point I bought the book. I went through Martin's book and basically created a spreadsheet with listing every episode and what the Goldsmith tracks were. Now, what Martin Grahams Jr. did not include was the sort of the time location. So the second person we have to thank, whose name eluded me the last time we recorded, is Dan Hollis, who posted on the Twilight Zone Cafe website sort of an ongoing thread about each musical cue in each episode, where it's found on the DVDs and the Blu-rays. And he has different times for each one based on whether they had a special logo at the front or not. Who wrote them, how much they overlapped. It's really quite thorough. He did not have the running time of each cue. So between those two, I was able to know where to stop and where to start to find these tracks. And then, of course, the third source to thank is Image Entertainment, who basically makes some of the best home video sets of television series ever. Their definitive edition Twilight Zone DVDs, which were, I believe, the second DVD release of the Twilight Zones, were considered definitive, where they were appropriately named. They had isolated scores. They had a lot of Mark Scott Zachree's original interviews that he did as a teenager, which led to his book, The Twilight Zone Companion. Those were included as alternate tracks. They had some radio shows. But then when they got around to doing the Blu-rays, as good as those definitive sets were, they just bumped up, both in quality, the Twilight Zones look amazing, but also, so like season one of The Twilight Zone, the number of isolated scores went from 20 to 34 out of the 36 episodes. Radio dramas went from 5 to 18. Commentaries went from 5 to 19. And then, of course, they had additional extras. They beefed up. They originally had a video, almost a kinescope copy of The Time Element, which is sort of considered an early Twilight Zone progenitor. Well, they had that in full restored Blu-ray quality. To be honest, there were one or two, maybe three episodes of The Twilight Zone that contained Goldsmith cues that I did not have an isolated score track for, and fortunately, most of those cues were generously available in other episodes, so the likelihood is that we got them. So I extracted the cues wherever I could find them. Often, a particular CBS library cue would be used maybe for 20 seconds in one episode, and then for 45 seconds in another episode, but the 20 seconds maybe started later and went further past the 45-second cue, so between the multiple uses, I threw them in an audio editor and lined them up and basically tried to create the longest, best-sounding individual segment of a CBS library cue that I could based on what we had.
What you've done is truly amazing.
Truly a monumental reconstruction task. I would probably not have the patience for it.
You know, as you would have, because every time you do one of these, you're like, that's a 2-minute Goldsmith cue. I mean, we're not going to get any more new Goldsmith music. It's been 14 years since he's been gone. So, you know, this is 40 minutes or so, if we decided, of music that we otherwise couldn't hear. And yeah, it's in little bits and bobs and tiny segments to a certain extent. It's more of the CBS early years kind of material, but it's still, for us, it's still new, previously unavailable Goldsmith. And that was very worth doing.
I think you're being generous to say that somebody else would have done it, because I'm pretty sure, David, you're the first person to actually take the time to do this. I haven't seen anyone on the Film Score Monthly board or other boards saying, you know, I went and excerpted all of the library music used in Twilight Zones on the isolated scores, and I pieced them together into the longest versions and fixed the audio and everything like that. You're the first person to do this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, all the three of us are very enthusiastic about Jerry Goldsmith, but I don't think any of us would have been able to tackle this project the way you have.
You are too humble.
Well, the nice thing is now nobody else has to, because thanks to you guys, they're going to have it. You've got a platform, and you've, this wasn't a show you had originally planned on doing, and now you're doing it, and that means that, you know, all the people on those boards, if they want to hear it, they can just hear it here.
Now I want to supplement your three sources that you thanked. We also owe thanks to the work of Bill Robel, who David used as a source for a lot of his research. And Bill has had access to a lot of documentation at CBS. And then when I started noticing some of your cue titles, it reminded me of a post on the Film Score Monthly board by Ron Burbella, who's a wonderful Jerry Goldsmith collector, who splurged on these Trans World 78s. These are not even regular LPs, but apparently in the early 60s, this was a British company that produced these library music discs from the CBS Music Library, and this particular disc set was all Jerry Goldsmith, with the exception of a single cue that was by someone else. And some of these overlap other things we've already covered, like the lineup, and I think maybe there's a Sergeant and the Lady cue on there.
There is a bunch of Sergeant and the Lady, for sure.
Yeah, and there's a few other things, but there were also some cue titles that sounded so familiar to me that I had to check with him and see if he could make us a copy of these discs, which he did, and I turned out to be correct. They lined up with some of the library cues used on The Twilight Zone. One of the early ones we'll discuss is City Mood, and another one is Jailbreak. And he was instrumental by supplying this material in helping you reconstruct the correct order for some of these fragments of cues, because these were the full pieces before being edited into a film context, even though the audio quality was much worse.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And take something like City Mood, for example, which we're going to play first. Basically, the pieces that were in the one use of it in Twilight Zone were about 15 seconds from the beginning and then maybe 35 seconds from the end. And of course, they had been edited together to form one 45-second-ish piece that fades in and fades out. But yeah, if he hadn't given me that, I wouldn't have known where those were. And you're right, there were pieces where Terrorstruck, which I mentioned on the last episode, I had two or three different sources, two or three completely different sounds. Like, it sounded like two different tracks, like The Camp at Night and Knife Fight. I mean, like, that different. And I just assumed that there had been a mistake. Well, one of Ron Berbella's tracks was called Terrorstruck, and it was those two pieces. And it's literally two cues that he put together and just gave one title to. There's even a complete fade out and a fade in. So you're right, those were extremely helpful. And your mention of the quality explains why I would have been, by the way, perfectly happy to discover that my work was all for naught if they'd had the same level of quality. I would love to have had all of his music and the quality we're getting from these isolated tracks. They're not. They're very scratchy. In some cases, we've included parts of his contributions, and in some cases, we haven't, just because they're so distracting that they kind of take away from the music experience.
Yeah, 78s, I think, deteriorate worse than regular LPs.
Yeah, to demonstrate, City Mood, which we're about to play, which is one of my two favorite pieces that we found, absolute favorite. It's Twilight Zone isolated for the first 15 seconds and the last 35 seconds. In the middle, it crossfades to Ron's Trans World contribution. And so you will hear a change in quality. This one we kept together because it doesn't destroy the listening experience. It is noticeable, but that'll give you an example of the level of materials that we're dealing with throughout the rest of the show.
Thank you.
you know, you can easily imagine a private eye going around a city investigating or something like that with this jazzy music.
Contemplating a mystery.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It has this simple underlying riff on a jazz bass with that kind of steady beat on the hi-hat. It undergoes an interesting journey over the two-minute running time.
I agree with David. I think this is one of the best cues from this batch. And it's sort of in a vein similar to some of Goldsmith's other, I guess we'll call them crime jazz scores, but it's more lush and mysterious than most of that material, and just has a really cool sound. I would love to hear something like this fleshed out into a full score.
Oh, so would I. I wrote that it sounds like music for a city at night as seen by a self-confident gumshoe. There's mysteriousness and confidence both in this. There's a sense of ability that's present in it. The music isn't diverted. The music isn't threatened. The city is misty and dank and very much home.
That's a beautiful description.
Better than the Easy Cue library would have done.
One zero for David over the Easy Cue library. Easily.
Yes.
One bizarre thing about this cue is how it's utilized in the Twilight Zone. Thinking about how we just talked about the cue, David, you brought this up to me original without giving it away, and when I checked it out, I was stunned.
I wanted to see how it was used in Twilight Zone because it was evocative the first time I heard it. When I extracted it from the soundtrack, my mind went places that I remember seeing in Twilight Zone, but in episodes that are scored more like Fair-Haired Boy and Man on the Beach with more sort of punchy, cool jazz, not this sort of wispy jazz. And I wanted to see, where is this played? What's going on? It was just so counter to the way the music, you know, so Robert Bresson said one of the reasons that film composers are heroes is because it's very easy when you hear music to come up with a picture. They have to do the opposite. They have to see a picture and come up with music. I hear this music and I come up with a picture. And I'll bet everyone who heard this when he played it came up with a very similar picture. An album cover.
It's wandering music.
Yeah, very evocative of walking, very evocative of the kind of hat worn in Double Indemnity or the Maltese Falcon, the kind of lighting on those posters. And yet this is used in a scene in the Twilight Zone that takes place in a library where two guys are talking and one of them is giving the other one a magic potion.
All right.
All made out, eh? One thing I must caution you about. You must use it immediately, do you hear me? Immediately. And you must use it all.
Immediately? Why? Will it spoil?
No, but you will. Once you delay, you are lost. Believe me. If you fail the first time you try to use it, you'll never have courage to use it again. Never.
Goodbye, Professor.
Farewell. Always the same way.
First stimulant?
And the chaser.
I think, David, I completely agree with you. It does not come off well to me. While it's mysterious, the cue is too evocative of a character who is in his métier, so to speak, to fill that seductive role that it is meant to fill in the chaser.
I don't know that when I saw the chaser that I heard that music play over that scene and thought, hey, there's a detective walking by. Why can't I see him? Or what's this music doing here? But having heard the music first and getting that image in my head, that's where I went. And then I saw the episode use it differently, which is either astonishingly clever or a bit off kilter for the music editor.
But the time for mood is over. Now is the time for action. The cue Jailbreak is a prime example of early Goldsmith bearing many of the stylistic hallmarks that he would develop and become famous for over the years. Built around a simple but aggressive brass ostinato, Goldsmith layers on dissonant string textures, sharp trumpet blasts, and martial percussion that comes first in contained bursts, but in the final third relentlessly drives the cue to its conclusion.
And for the listener, the beginning comes from Ron's Transworld disc, and then it's going to get better as it goes into the Twilight Zone. And this is one of the last times until the end of the program we're going to hear the Transworld. Most of the rest of the stuff's coming from isolated scores. So we wanted to start and get these two. One, they're great cues. Two, they both have those Transworld elements. We wanted to get that quality change out of the way early.
Thank you.
I agree that this is very much in Goldsmith's action style, and you can hear bits and pieces of other things that he would do later in this. But I also think there's a lot of Bernard Herrmann in this cue, too, particularly in the earlier part of the cue. You hear some of that Herrmann-esque intense action music. And then later, you know, once you have the rolling military percussion sort of kicking in later, it kind of feels more fully Goldsmith.
I think this is because it's a strong example of his mixed meter action writing. It goes between triple, and then it has three beats followed by five. So it goes 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's right. Yes.
And that keeps getting beaten out on the timpani with the horns blaring over it. And it's so iconically Goldsmith to me that I don't dispute that there was a Herrmann connection early on, but it's not the impression I'm left with after I've listened to the track. For me, it's actually more Jerry Goldsmith sounding than a similar cue he wrote for the jailbreak in Black Patch.
You always were stubborn.
That one's a little more halting, and it doesn't have that sort of momentum to it.
But whatever the case, a thrilling piece of music, to be sure.
For me, this cue, because of the sustained energy and action, it almost comes across like it was written to picture, because it has different episodes within the cue, which felt like they could match different shots cutting in during the action. Maybe Jerry just wrote it that way in order that it could be cut too. But the latter half has these really cool brass punctuations that I love.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
which yeah. You imagine there is something happening on screen that he's accompanying rather than just writing it generically out there.
Mm-hmm.
This cue, perhaps more so than other Wild Library cues, I think comes off less wild in context. Like if it's used well, it feels like it may have actually been specifically written for the context that it's in.
I agree. Jailbreak was used three times in Twilight Zone, and all three of them are pretty much what you would expect. They're basic action scenes. In two of them, the piercing trumpets are just part of the music. They just overlay and they're there. There's a street fight. There are some guys running around trying to find a man overboard. But in one of them, those trumpets hit right when a car is about to go over a cliff. And it works in both ways. It works as just being underlying music, but it also works when they take that moment and time it to the most important part of the action scene.
After all this exciting action, I think we need something lush and pretty to let us safely come down from this high. Some harp, perchance, and a string melody that'll help us think back on better days.
That sounds like just the ticket.
This one is called Remember.
As far as the sourcing, it's used exactly once in The Twilight Zone in Season 4, Episode 1, No Time Like the Past. It's a character who tries to go through time to prevent horrible things from happening, and it doesn't work, so he just decides to go back in time and live in the happy simplicity of Homeville, Indiana in 1881. And this music is played as he arrives and is walking around looking at a small town being a wonderful small town and exactly what he hoped. It's perfectly used. I mean, it's just basically lovely. And the main note I wrote is only Jerry could make 4/4 time feel like it's really a waltz.
You know, I really think the reason you have that association is because of the Marriage of Strangers connection in this case, because the original Marriage of Strangers love theme is a waltz.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, the B section is identical to A Marriage of Strangers, but the primary section of this new theme is in 4/4 time, and the melody is a bit different. It's got maybe a little more of a Western sound, and it doesn't have that waltz rhythm to it.
My theory of R is that this is just kind of a break-off cue from those re-recording sessions that Jerry did for Marriage of Strangers. Where you just figured, oh, I've got another variant that I can use another way, that I can add here.
Very possible.
But the primary section of the theme is totally different and in a different time signature. What if he composed this library music first and then he liked it so much, maybe he modified it into the love theme from A Marriage of Strangers, kept the B section the same, and then developed it through an entire score because he liked the melody so much.
That could be it. You know, I don't want that nice little theme to languish away in the CBS Music Library waiting for a proper home. I'm going to build a score around it.
And change it just enough so that it's, you know, not a complete ripoff or
legally distinct.
Prevent Goldsmith from suing himself.
Because we have to keep in mind that this could have been written and recorded before A Marriage of Strangers, even though it was used on The Twilight Zone after.
Oh, that's certainly true.
But it's a lovely little piece, very sentimental and wistful and sweet. I like it.
It has kind of an Americana feel.
Oh, it has such a rustic and pastoral quality to it.
Hello, listeners. Jens here. So, as I was editing this latest podcast episode, the realization dawned on me that the sheer volume of exclusive new Goldsmith material that we wanted to premiere was simply too much for a single show. So, with a lot more new music still to be heard, we decided to publish part two of this look into the CBS archives in 2 weeks. For now, I leave you with the full, unedited version of my favorite cue off the Prometheus album, The Villagers.